first home, I have an aunt, and she was a wonderful craft woman. And I found a blank box that she had made, and it was complete with a soft cushioned leather at the top. I don't know if you know the size. And the minute I lifted the lid of the box, I was back in her world. I could smell her parlour hitting my lungs when I opened the lid of the blanket box. So this first poem is dedicated to her and is called Journey. When I lift the hand-stitched leather of my aunt's blanket box, I am in her parlour, misty in late light. She is sitting, her ringless fingers working the corner. Quiet work, punctuated with small sighs as the needle loops the leather. Out through the window, I hear the empty silence around the lowing cows. Their thin legs, yellowed by buttercups, retrace the narrow path. Bring me to the meadow, the rushy drain, and the fairy rath, where startled gnats and other winged things move up an octave of air to let me in. Thank you. A lot of my poems are fairly short, so don't worry about capping, but if you want to relax them, give me a standing ovation at the end, or a Mexican wave, but we'll see how it goes, but don't worry about clapping, it doesn't matter, thank you. It's a cruel fact that St. Mary's Cathedral in Kilkenny was built during the famine, and my next poem is called Pandemonium, which means full of demons. He tells me I have a poor sense of direction. I beg to differ. I know I have failed to find the famine graves hidden in Callan, yet they haunt my mind. Hushed grass swaying from starved bones powdered by time. I keep seeing green grapes for nothingness, lost grace. St. Mary's Cathedral, on the other hand, cannot be missed, much as I try. A black grievous blow in the sky. It muscles into its space while bodies rotted on the roadside. God's structure indeed. Where was Christ to turn stones to bread, to make coffins for the fresh dead? He was off building pandemonium instead. Thank you. I think about joy and rebirth and things like that. It's very personal, and you don't often experience it in the ritual. This poem is called Easter, and it's about one of my sons, Michael, at Easter one year. By the church brimmed with incense, and the choir high in the gallery intoned high mass, all stops pulled out to glorify Christ's resurrection, the nine-year-old refashioned gospel sheets into paper planes that he launched after communion and before the final blessing. What perfect art they made over the bowed heads. How their rising delighted him, hunkered on the leather kneeler, launch pad of his own creation, his face lifted and lit. I think along the way we all get a bit battered and bruised, and we cope with that, thanks to God. We all cope with it in some way and carry it. And then every so often, you have to take a rain check and realize that some of the suffering isn't going away easily or it's rising up. And then a few years ago, I went for counseling because I couldn't bury stuff. And this poem is for my counselor. I wrote it for her. And the river in it, I suppose, is the river of experience and feelings that you try to steer clear of. The counselor might help you with it. It's called To the Trainer on the Bank. I am the pup nosing at the water's edge. You are the trainer on the bank. I'm wary of the moving mass, but I wade in. When I have skirted the shallows in that up and down way of snippers, you hook me with a question, throw me deeper, out of my depth, and I am forced to swim. Never for too long, you call me back before my wet nose drowns. I catch my breath and you begin again. You will not bring me round. You let me learn that I can save myself. And while you're suffering, I think our minds search and cling to images that are good and that will give us strength. And it can be a name or it can be a face. And the next two poems celebrate this capacity of the imagination. The blighted room in this first poem is actually the suffering mind. It's called Your Face. In the blighted room, I tried on your face, your merry eyes, your attentiveness. Then I sat opposite, talked to you, allowed your good self to listen. Except you weren't there. And later, when the ogres came, and like a godsend, you appeared. It was a torn break to realize your absence, my unrivaled isolation, and the good part of me in its chosen shape, your beloved face. And the second one along that theme is called Kitchen Heat. Too alone, I cracked and called your name again. It was like standing in the cold garden when the door opened. Kitchen heat embraced me in a swell, coming from the burning oven whose door, when opened, releases in a rush sweet-scented energy surging out of itself. I will explain all this to you when I see you. And maybe like before, across the room will come love. We are more permeable than we think. The first poem I wrote was for my mother. Her name is Pearl. And after she died, her bag of clothes pegs ended up in our kitchen. So this poem is for my mother Pearl, and it's called Link. I secure the billowing clothes to the line, pegged between my lips. Through the window, I watched you expertly filling the line, shuffling and pulling against you, pegs clamped in your mouth. It was a habit I thought old-fashioned, unnecessary, a housekeeper's way. Now, those whitened, worn pegs are as precious as a touch of your fingertips. My lips impress upon those anchoring hinges that knew your lips too. Link to our last kiss, when, in my house, I helplessly gave you mouth to mouth, frantic lips on stilts. Change of tone now. I live in a housing estate, and in a housing estate, houses all look the exact same. But in truth, behind those walls, there are so many different standards of homemaking, and I suspect a very different style of lovemaking too. And the next very short poem illustrates this point, I think. It's called Love Stains. What happened to your cream, shag pile carpet? I exclaimed. Love Stains, she replied dreamily. Love Stains. Another quick, swift change of tone. It's about a note of the day that I knew, and she was just innocently carrying on her morning routine when a knock came on her door that was to change her life. And the last line of this poem is her line, what she said. The poem is called New. Sun spans the family room. Mother hummed as she dusted strained faces. Father sipped tea, reading the desk. Firewood spat, the radio murmured. The dog lay, panting slightly, occasionally his tail pumped. Distorted in the frosted glass, two guards. He opened the door, blew the tinge to the room. She gripped the last frame. Which one of them is it? And an another neighbor of mine is on holidays in France with her husband and two small boys. And while she was there, she found a lump in her breast. And again, in that instant, her world has changed. But this poem tries to rewind time away from the discovery, back to the happiness that happens before that discovery. So it's like rewinding the video. It's called Time. Before I stumble on the lump in my breast, I unlather myself, close in my body, quench the water, back out of the shower, redress myself in cotton, reverse down the stairs with a lift in my footfall, swing into the garden, play seek and hide with my children, who beg me not to go under a shadow-free summer sky. I had an operation myself this time 2 years ago, and in fact all my healing happened here in Cork. I was in Victoria Hospital, then I was out in the University Hospital, and they were all very kind to me down here. But there's an element of adventure about the whole thing, unexpected surprise. And for example, when I woke up after the first operation, I had a whole line of staples on my stomach, and they were metal, and I just didn't know that was going to happen, so it was a bit of a surprise. And I reminded myself of a zipped handbag I looked like a zip down there, so this poem is called The Wound. I am like a zipped handbag, soft as good leather. The nurse cleans my wound, catches cotton on metal. While I was asleep, your hand disappeared into my flesh, which you had opened. I wonder who held me together while the staples were punched. Afterwards, while you scrubbed out, I woke to the sound of my scream and the voice of the nurse firmly repeating my name, bringing me back to myself. Once in a workshop, we were given the challenge of writing about a taboo. So brace yourself for a taboo, so it's called the promiscuous door. Absorbed in that unique bathroom concentration, I caught sight of myself, becoming aware of myself, complete and bulbous, in the brass knob of the promiscuous door. The googly eye of it out on its stalk, the gaunt cheek of it. I grasped the towel and lost sight of myself, losing sight of myself as the white fold fell to the floor. Sexual abuse of children, unfortunately, is common, and this next poem pictures the mindset of an abuser and the possible consequence for him. It's called Milking Time. Cocked on his three-legged stool, hair pricking his ear, he eats milk from her. The cow shifted, he slapped her hide, knowing better she stood mutely to let him complete the job at hand. It had been short-sighted, fingering the girl in its heyday, exploring her surface. She had seemed passive, innocent enough. Now, as his house crumbles and his farm goes to seed, there's a price to pay. He felt the tit and the note. And this would have a healing poem. This one's called The Tending. The door swung inwards on the changing room, where ladies, fresh from the aqua aerobics mid-morning class, were dressing. There they were, an oatmeal glow hung in the air. One woman dried her toes, another brushed her hair. I entered their arena just as the piped music, a mild instrumental of All You Need Is Love, came to its chorus, and the ladies joined in. Soft, powdered voices opened out like a scent as the tending continued. Love is all you need. Love is all you need. Sometimes a poem can be a very playful and powerful advocate. This poem is another unknown lady, but hopefully powerful. It's called To a Dumbstruck Admirer. I'll be your dictionary. Slip through the find the words you want to say. I'll arch my spine for you, stretch open wide for you, run your fingers down my frame. I know that you're not dumb. Let me untie your tongue. Lick your lips, don't be afraid. I am your word reserve. Let's have some intercourse. Go on, lift me off the page. Jesus is a notion I've always had problems with. I just haven't got a handle on it yet. Well, I'm getting there, but I just wonder about it. You know, when you're feeling angry and something's going on, come on. And they often say, bury the hatchet. So this poem is called Bury the Hatchet. And the problem of burying the hatchet, I hope you get the swing of it. I'm burying the hatchet in my thinking brain. I'm burying the hatchet. I'm thinking it again. Yes, I'm burying it. I'm burying the solid axe with its slim edge. I split the mercurial memory, sink the silver blade. It drops, then pops up again. But I'll bury it. I will. I'll throw my weight behind it. Bury it. I must bury the hatchet in the sticky wood of my head. But I suppose an interesting thing is that will wins out of the feelings in the end. I really think it does. And this poem is addressed to my cave mother. Back there somewhere, I had a cave mother, as all of you did. And I like to think that while my cave father was off somewhere shooting spears at deer or getting the dinner, my cave mother was at home discovering fire. Often in the book in the primary school, it was a man who discovered fire. But I like to think she was keep going there for the babies, and that it was her who made the discovery of fire. This is called Cave Mother. You squat over twigs, suspended in the task of shooting flames from your cold hands to the gaping tinder. You can summon nearly at will this heat, this brain. Density of desire holds you, repeatedly you strike. Colors at last split the air, ignite in the shelter of your crouched legs, in the flinty concentrate of your eyes. It's a poem called Joy. I'm just imagining it. Thin enough. I drove up the multi-levels of the city car park, past all the parked clutter of the lower deck. Up the small ramp, up, I circled upwards, through the dark spaces, shafted by light, along the cement walls, broken by colours breaking in, propelled by my own steady speed, driven by my own acceleration, to the pinned-out spaces, where little is left, until at last, the darkness is diluted too much, and I break beyond the building to light, blessed light. He had a lecturer at college, and he was wonderfully articulate. But one day he couldn't think of a word, and when I can't think of a word, I'd say it's on the tip of my tongue. But he said it's on the penumbra of my consciousness. So this poem is called Penumbra. All day catching me, this layer lifting from the wall of my brain. Like peeling paint, eyes absently in the living room, but never quite leaving the surface to curl into consciousness, never quite entering the energy where abstracts are recognized for real. And this poem is called Signed Over, to that whole phenomenon of older men giving their farms to younger men. He signed over the farm, moved to the granny flat. Muffled voices seep from the end wall. He paces the perimeter of the non-slip tile, immune to remote controls, bright panic buttons. From the new window, his old eyes see beyond the wrought iron gate. He reels in the fallow field, ruptures the stout trunk, wave up to the dog too long on it. Muse on the hour, adult him. He fiddles the dial. The voices twist, don't topple, static. On Friday, a friend of mine, Jeremy, released his CD, and I helped him out with the lyrics. It's completely for charity. It's a charity called Kilimanjaro Direct. And every penny that's made from the CD, he's hoping to make 15,000, it's going directly to Kilimanjaro Direct. And then they're going to build a school, they'll build a school for 15,000. So I've shamelessly brought the CDs here. We're pleased and we'd love it if you wanted to buy them. And if they're a tenner, and every penny of that tenner, or cent of that tenner, goes directly to the charity. And I'm doing a very audacious thing now. I'm going to read you just the lyrics of one of them, because I can't sing. And then just to give you a flavour of it, I suppose, this poem is called Fire Watching Man, and it's meant to be a ballad. So I'll just read it through, but you'll understand much of it. Lost in your chair by the fire, quiet man, you gaze into worlds that come tumbling down. You don't say a word with your teacup in hand, but there's fire in your eyes, silent fire watching man. Do you see a flickering dancer with bracelets of gold on her wrist? As she twirls, is she your enchanter, beckoning fingers are your burning kiss? Is there a house on the glowing turf mountain that you imagine is home? Is there a place on which you are counting, collapsing in fragments of orange and gold? Do you hear the echo of laughter rippling across the cold? What is it that you're hankering after, dreams all ablaze in the ashes and smoke? Lost in your chair by the fire, quiet man, you gaze into worlds that come tumbling down. You don't say a word with your teacup in hand, but there's fire in your eyes, silent fire watching man. And we're nearly finished now, two more poems. But then this poem catches that moment, you know, in the relationship when it's all very top loaded with feelings and finding your way and fragile and delicate. Worth it, but it's at that stage. And then it moves to the point where you're relaxed together and you're just moves more easily. Well, that the poem is trying to capture that turn, and the poem is called Turning. You know part two of making the Christmas cake. To the creamed bowl already comes the fall of plump fruit. How gingerly you sink the wooden spoon, cupping the fruit and turning it into the cream, scooping and working it in. Then the real work begins. You find your stride and with ready strength you turn and turn. We are at that easy speed. The spoon moves smoothly and all is flexible. Like the ship, having turned in the harbour, in that careful way of something tremendous in a shallow space, now happily is at sea, its great churning engine milling the ocean. The last day is often pictured as a day of judgment and terror. And I like to think the last day might be more, hopefully, a return to a state of innocence and maybe complete perfection. I wrote this on the last day of the writing week in Anna McCarrick called The Last Day. It was a fertile kind of day. Hazy mist, kissing wet, drawing creatures out. As I circled the green wood, I met them, larger than life, the big boned hare, moss-nosing deer. We all had a good look at each other, and I was sorry for their sake that I wasn't buck naked and mossy, naturally fitting the slow blessing of our unabashed regard. My final poem, slightly longer, slightly lighter, finish on a lighter note, called Confessions of a Cleaning Lady. Of all all the places I have changed, my favorite is the state museum. Amid the gods of Greece and Rome, I democratize and shine the crown. I was the bird, a paragon of scenes in the Pantheon. I love the moon, Zeus, Eros, Cupid, but the one that really knocked me stupid was the full bronze 7-foot deep Apollo in his birthday suit. And despite the warning, do not touch, I wanted to touch very much. He had a layer of dust and grime. My duster ached to make him shine. One Valentine's Day, I was inspired to pray on this god I so admired. With bated breath, I could hardly cope. I eased myself behind the rope, and 6 inches from Apollo, I bit my claw into my breast. Upon my little two-step ladder, I gave his golden crown a lather. He stared ahead with a distant smile. So he commenced to drive me wild. I worked my way down his stairs. My hands were busy, my fingers eager. His chest glimmered, his nipples gleamed. His scowl was better than I had dreamed. Yet I hesitated with a qualm just beneath the diaphragm. Even the hottest cleaner round knows that there is holy ground. So I diverted to his toes, and through the dirt the glow arose. I briskly rubbed his handsome knees and inched on upwards by degrees. His thighs were muscular and hard, no dimples cellulite, no lard. This man of such immense proportions had my insight in contortion. Until sweet mode, I must divulge. I carefully polished the polished bulge. You wouldn't believe the dust suspended behind and beneath the bronze attendant. He glowed all over when I abated. My bust Apollo radiated. His body shone with a golden luster, thanks to the magic of my duster. I'd say he'd never been rubbed that way, but I gave it to him on Valentine's Day.